Talk given Sunday, 9th January 1977. For the benefit of those who are here for the first time, let me say a few words about our groups. What is it for which we meet here? Man is essentially a religious being, and only secondarily is he a political, economic, and social animal. The flowering of his religiousness is perhaps the fundamental purpose of his existence on the planet. Because without the flowering of this religiousness in him, he is still in a subhuman state. If you look carefully into the meaning of the word human, it's a tremendous significance and all the implications attached to that significance. You will see that to be human, meaning to be the happy creator, not in the sense of someone who puts things together and makes them, but in the sense of one who is completely in tune with the creative rhythm of life itself throughout the universe. And he is aware of this. And he is no longer obstructive to this process. Then he has come to his full human stature. That is a meaning implied in the word human, from the Sanskrit root man, which in the dictionary is translated as to think. But this thinking is not our sort of thinking, which is only concept forming, using words as the species with which we construct our concepts. All this belongs to the realm of mortality, of death. In terms of consciousness, remember, the body, of course, the organism will inevitably die, whether you're saint or sinner, makes no difference. But in terms of consciousness, it's the realization of immortality, of utter purity and utter perfection as far as this particular organism called the human being is concerned. And this particular organism is utterly different as far as this planet goes from all other living creatures on this planet. It is not merely a case of the flowering out of what we commonly call our intelligence or our social virtues or our ethical standards and all the rest of it. All that belongs to the realm of mortality still, because we as mortals, with our conditioned minds, define these things. And because the mind is imperfect, its definitions are necessarily imperfect. They fall short of the supreme reality. You may inquire, well, what makes you talk about the supreme reality? Do you know it? What is your authority for it? Questions like that arise. I have no authority for it. But the fact remains that throughout the ages, there have arisen men here, there, time and again. Throughout the centuries they have arisen, they exist today too, who have realized this state of true, full humanity, which is the perfect human. And they have always declared that this perfect human is, well, sometimes they use the phrase the Son of God. In the Hindus talk of him as the Brahmaputra. The Buddhists talk of him as the Arahant, the worthy one. And as regards the Arahant, he is one who has done what there had to be done. For him there are no more, there is no more a succession of conditioned states. Rather inadequately and misleadingly translated as birth and rebirth. Birth and rebirth is something which we misconceive very badly. There is no more a succession of conditioned states. And for one who has realized this supreme condition, there is no hereafter in terms of a conditioned state. Na parang ithattaya. This has to be borne in mind very carefully. So, our concern here is the release of this religiousness in us. Immediately one thinks in terms of, oh, what is the method, what is the way? The way is you yourself, your own living being, your own living process from moment to moment is the way. You can be helped by others up to a point, but that point is very, very easily reached. It is your awareness, your consciousness, which has to free itself from all the limitations imposed by one's own subhumanity upon oneself. And the release of true humanity is there. A mode of awareness of existence, remember it's all in terms of awareness, a mode of awareness of existence where all the seeds of conflict, of confusion, of disorder are no more. And all the energies, the life energies, which mankind misdirects in his life, are now conserved and allowed to be utilized by totality, the one total reality, by transcendence itself, for its own spontaneous, natural purposes. This, I've tried to put very, very briefly the meaning of the release of religiousness in us. Now, when that happens, one is the simple, pure, spontaneous, natural, human being at home in his own organism, at home in the world in which he lives, wheresoever he may be. Do not regard this as a super idealistic philosophy. There is nothing idealist about it. An ideal is merely the culmination of ideas or an idea in the mind of a thinker. The thinkers of the world are 4,000 millions. I'm complimenting a good many people, but anyhow, 4,000 million people do undergo thought processes. What sort of thinking is it? You know very well what sort of thinking it is. Confused, limited, biased, prejudiced, full of unwarrantable assumptions, preconceptions, and so on and so on. You see, all that has to be out. Now, let us then proceed from there. The way is in your own living being. No one can compel you. Transcendence itself never compels. Transcendence is embodied in us. The devil also lives in us quite happily. He is the one, the devil self in me is the one that constantly tries to seduce me, to tempt me this way and that way. Transcendence does nothing, leaves you alone, so that you have the chance to realize your true aloneness, which means your true wholeness and not loneliness. Do you realize that? If you realize your true aloneness, then you will also be in complete relationship with everyone and everything in the right way. Because then you will not impose the self upon the world around you. You will not be in conflict with the world. Being in right relationship, the right action will follow. And so forth. So the way is through you yourself. The method. How can anyone lay down a method for you? You are the living being. You know your own mind, mental processes, your own thoughts, your feelings. Others can't see them. There is that element in each and every one of us which is one's personal sanctum, so to say. Transcendence doesn't invade that sanctum. The devil does. I'm using the word devil, you know, conveniently, that's all. Why doesn't transcendence invade that sanctum and try to force you to come to fruition and perfection? Because that sanctum is transcendence itself. And I, the psychophysical organism, the self-oriented person, am the one who covers that sanctum with veil after veil and prevents the truth, the glory, the beauty of transcendence from flowering out through this finite organism, myself. So you see, obviously the method must necessarily be one which consists essentially in the removal of the veils. And who can remove those veils in your own inner sanctum but you yourself? No one else can do it. Do you ask somebody else to eat on your behalf and digest it for you? Digest that food for you? You may ask, but it can never happen. It is the same here. You have to do it yourself. You have to see for yourself. You have eyes, you have ears, therefore you see things, you hear sounds, and so forth. This inner light is something which cannot be shown you. It is something which is there, which with the eye of the spirit, the mind's eye, the third eye, if you like, becomes visible. A pure light, a pure flame, which warms and enlightens, but doesn't scorch or burn or destroy. When we make our mistakes, that same light, that same flame, scorches us, blinds us. That is why the Hindus have a wonderful saying, before you dare to look directly at the sun, see that your eyes are capable of standing that light. It's an extraordinary saying, but one worthy of deep contemplation. I think Enough of that by way of introduction. It might be helpful to us now, in relation to what I've already said, to consider together, that means you also must work, not just listen passively, but listen alertly, allowing your own listening process to work the transformation within your own being. Let us consider together some of the deep implications of the Buddha's teachings with regard to the process which we call mindfulness. You find that in the Noble Eightfold Path, as it is called, of the Buddha, the last two aspects are termed Samasati and Samadhi. Sati, Sama means perfect. It's often translated as right. But right is a word which is not strong enough in the context. The word perfect is really a better word to use in this context. It is the perfect mindfulness, sati. And samadhi means communion, togetherness, the complete togetherness. If you translate it as concentration, a difficulty arises this way. Our own ordinary experience in life makes concentration an act involving the exclusion of anything that intrudes upon or disturbs that which you personally desire to attend to. You see, the personal aspect is there. The self is there. When you personally desire to concentrate your attention upon God, you are trying to grasp God or Brahman, or use any word you like. You are trying to grasp that for yourself. Take a teacup and let me know when you finish the job. How many teacupfuls is the Atlantic Ocean? To try to grasp transcendence, to try to grasp God, is totally impossible. It is transcendence within which we live and move and have our total being. It is transcendence which comes to fruition and flowering through oneself, the purified vehicle, the living vehicle of transcendence. And it comes to fruition through each one of us in terms of man. Transcendence manifesting as man. You look at beautiful flowers. It's transcendence manifesting as beautiful flowers. Or the mountains. It's transcendence manifesting that. Or the great galaxies, or anything you like. And through this particular creature called man, transcendence is coming to fruition as the perfect man. So, you can't grasp God. You can't concentrate upon God, so to say. Try concentrating your attention upon space and see what happens. Try concentrating your attention upon pure energy, not the forms of energy that science knows of. Electricity, heat, gravitational energy, mechanical energy, any chemical energy, any form of energy. Not that, but energy per se. We don't know it. Or try to concentrate your attention upon your own mind, as we say. What is mind? Can anybody produce mind upon a silver salver and show it to me? You can't. It's a word whose meaning we don't really know. It can be suggested. that mind is the receptive, responsive sensitivity which characterizes the living organism called man. There you have perhaps one of the least restrictive ways, formulation in words, to suggest what mind might be. The receptive, responsive sensitivity characterizing the living organism. And that sensitivity finds secondary, its secondary state is in terms of expression, which invariably is limited, expression in terms of concepts and words. See? So now, you cannot set about it that way. We can only set about that which is within our limited mortal experience. Our flaws, as we call them, as well as our virtues, as we call them. And this is a very important point. What we call our virtues and our vices are two aspects of our own psychical energy patterning itself in one way, which is painful, destructive, unenlightening, and so forth, and in another way, which tends towards enlightenment or fruition. In other words, we live in this state of duality, and the duals are everlastingly in conflict. We are taught, we have been taught throughout the centuries, fight the evil, overcome the evil, and bring about the triumph of the good. And particularly theistically minded people have the tendency to define the good. How can I, an ignorant person, know what is truly good? No lesser person than Jesus said, "Why callest thou me good? There is only one that is good, and that is God, the unknown and the unknowable." So it's very significant. If I can transcend both the duals within the ambivalence sphere of virtue-vice, if I transcend both the duals, then the energy which is represented in a constructive or destructive form by each dual is totally and completely transformed, transmuted into divine energy. Something which you can't describe, but something which is a reality. And one of the supreme signs of that reality is that that sort of person naturally and spontaneously is the embodiment of all that you, provided you are not, one is not, one hasn't got a diseased mind, finds the most desirable state. Desirable, not in the sense of grasping for oneself, but in the sense of perfection and beauty in itself. So, samasati, perfect mindfulness. And samadhi, the perfect togetherness, the perfect communion, which is not to be understood as concentration which excludes anything. Because we live in a cosmos, a unitary whole. We don't live in a multiverse. We live in a universe, a one thing. You see? And it is that one thing, that one thingness, shall I say, of which we are unaware, unawakened to it. Oh. perfect mindfulness, perfect communion, perfect relationship. This is samadhi, the complete togetherness. And in that state there is no such thing as selfness, therefore. Wheresoever there is selfness, there is an intrusion by you or me upon the unitary wholeness of the one total reality. And this is the state of sin. This is what brings about conflict, sorrow, suffering, misery all the time. Now, this mindfulness, what do we mean by this mindfulness? This power to be aware, clearly aware, of everything that goes on. From moment to moment, both outside oneself and within oneself. That is to say, within oneself in terms of one's own reaction in thought and feeling to whatsoever stimulus comes into one through the avenues of the senses. And the Buddha suggested, when you see an object, see it, scrutinize it, he said, completely, fully, in its general appearance and in its details, but do not get entranced by it, do not get repelled by it. That is what we have to be. We have to be on the lookout for that. If we are entranced by it, we get attached to it, and that attachment gives rise to craving, to the desire to repeat the experience again and again. This is a fundamental mistake. One can never repeat exactly as one has experienced. Once the experiencing process is over, it is finished. It is there. It is gone. You can never exactly repeat. But there is memory. You retain the memory of the shape of what? Not of the living experiencing, but of the dead fossil of what was a living experience. And it is this which produces the disappointment and the misery and all the rest of it. No. Completely let go. Do not block the stream of life, in other words. Therefore, the Buddha said, do not be entranced either by the general appearance or by the details thereof when you see anything. So you become free of attachment. You become free of greed. And if you become free of greed, you can also more easily become free of repulsion, of hate, of envy, of jealousy, and so forth. That is the opposite reaction to attachment, aversion. Aversion and attachment, both of them are equally sources of conflict. And if the psyche is in a state of conflict, it is impossible to see truly, to see the fact as the fact. When one's own mind is conditioned in this way, then whatsoever comes through the senses is always distorted by that mind. You never see truly, you never hear truly, or touch truly. In fact, one cannot truly observe as a human being, a fully human being should observe. To see the fact as the fact. You see the whole fact as it is. You see it as pleasant, unpleasant, as far as it's, far as the sensational reactions which must necessarily take place in the body are concerned. It's pleasant, unpleasant. But then the other aspect comes in, the difficulty. The psyche says, I like, and wants to grasp and to repeat. If it is repulsive, the psyche says, I dislike this, I want to get rid of it, I want to destroy it. But you see, the roots of conflict are there. Perpetual conflict. And because this state of conflict and confusion, this state of not being in complete relationship with what is happening, is always present, therefore there is sorrow. There is unending sorrow. There is no possibility then of meditation or prayer in the true sense of those words. No possibility. You will also see, therefore, that specifically laid down methods of meditation are rendered inefficient and ineffectual unless there is this mindfulness which enables one to be free of attachment and aversion. Those of you who do yoga, for instance, pratyahara is the fifth step in the Hatha Yoga series. You start with the yama, niyama, and you proceed to the postures, asana, to what is commonly called the control of breath, pranayama, and then the fifth stage, pratyahara, which has been very misleadingly translated as a withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. If you really succeeded in withdrawing your sense activities and sense functions from the objects of sense, that will be the end of your organism before very long. Or you'll be just completely crazy, really lunatic, you see. It does not mean that. It means being free of the bondage produced in terms of attachment or aversion when the sense functions are active in relation to the objects of sense. That is what pratyahara really means. You see? So, one begins to see how the different stages, if I may use that word, I'm not happy using that word stages in this context, but still, it's the first word that comes to mind. You see the stages of the release of inner freedom. You see the fact as the fact. You make no mistake about it. But when you see the fact as the fact, and you're free of attachment and aversion, many other things happen. In order to be really free of attachment and aversion, all are fixed, the emphasis is on the word fixed, are fixed standards of judgment, are conditioned modes of evaluation, and so forth. They are all out. Consider, if 10 people are told such and such an event took place involving human behavior, human motives, and so forth, all 10 of them will react quite differently to that same event. Why? Because the 10 different minds are differently conditioned. They are in different states of confusion, of aversion, of attachment, of belief, of concepts, of ought to be's, ought not to be's, and all the rest of it. Therefore, you don't see truth. And what is associated with not seeing truth, you cannot really be compassionate and understanding. And unless you have pure understanding, full understanding, and true compassion, which you cannot conjure up or pursue and produce out of the kitty for the benefit of the other, it just naturally and spontaneously is there. Because these words, compassion and understanding, in the religious context, are actually in the transcendent context, and they are words to suggest the manner in which the energy of transcendence functions through us, living human beings, in relationship to each other. You see how utterly different everything becomes when we really try to go to live the religious life. Mere study, mere practice of a method, of a particular method, is often rather childish and certainly immature. You have to awaken from within, really awaken. And recognize also when oneself is not awakened. Because the organism will get tired. The human organism has considerable abilities, a considerable range of elasticity. But one does come to the end of that. One does get tired. And then one has to relax, let go. Go to sleep and rest. Really rest. Let it go. Let the horse take you out of the forest in which you've lost your way. His horse sense will be far better than my conceited, stupid cleverness. All right. Now, when this happens, what actually takes place with respect to one's state of relationship with those around, one's own family, one's own community, society, mankind, and the state of things in the world. We will see that we are on the way to realizing a state of poise, an inward poise, a position of true strength. Do you realize that strength in the religious context does not mean the possession of power with which to bring about your desired result, or to oppose anybody else, or destroy the evil, and so forth. It doesn't mean that at all. Strength in the religious context, which is the context of transcendence, means infinite resilience. The word comfort, which literally means with strength, force fortis, strong, with strength. Comfort is infinite resilience. That which is infinitely resilient is obviously indestructible. when I suppose this might particularly apply to little boys rather than girls, and they feel very strong in themselves, you know, they draw out their toy swords and go slashing the air to bits. That is what mankind does, trying to slash the air around to bits. Can't do it. It's absurd, childish, immature. But adults very seriously engage in that kind of activity. So, strength means infinite resilience. And infinite resilience does not mean a spineless, supine, static condition, or a condition where you bend something else to your will. Not at all. It means, essentially, you absorb everything in your own psyche. You endure it in the right meaning of the word endure. Not that rather soured attitude, he says, well, we've got to put up with it. Not at all. You are awake. You are mindful. You're truly mindful. Therefore, you are observant, free of any conditioned state of the mind. You're really seeing, you're really hearing, and so forth. Therefore, you take the whole thing into your own psyche. Remember, the psyche is unkillable. As long as the living organism is there, the living organism, you can slash off an arm or a leg or something. You can't slash off any bit of the psyche, whatever happens. If the brain is damaged, then there are psychological results. But if the brain is not damaged, then the psyche is unkillable. It can be hurt, because pleasure, pain is a psychical recording. Joy, sorrow is a psychical reaction. So that is there, but the psyche is unkillable. Now, if you just remain poised, absorb everything into the psyche, and remain alert and awake, seeing the fact as the fact. I keep on repeating this because this is very important. Seeing the fact as the fact. A process of transformation takes place in your own psyche. You learn the full lesson out of the immediate moment. And in learning that full lesson, you are truly alive. You're truly living, and you're living without imposing yourself, without intruding the self upon the world. What a different state from the commoner garden state of the 4,000 millions on the globe. You are neither harming the world or yourself, nor are you bent upon another childish, immature procedure, running about do-gooding. The do-gooding is to pamper and satisfy one's own egoism and vanity. When one is free of that, then the real good will naturally and spontaneously be continuously done by oneself, without a thought out, a planned out do-gooding. The action is natural, spontaneous, and it is intelligent and far more efficient than the action of the imperfect-minded do-gooder, because he sees the fact as the fact and knows exactly this is the thing that I can do, and he does it at once. So action and perception, seeing the fact, seeing the truth, take place simultaneously. The action need not always be physical. Very often it is best to be free of physical activity. Perhaps it is not exaggerated to say that 99% of the daily doings and the physical actions of mankind are futile waste and rubbish. If we only were quiet, society would be quiet, the nation would be quiet, the world would be quiet. If we were quiet, we can get together and consider things together. For what? Not for one's own advantage. Look what happens after a war. How they consider matters and draw up their peace treaties. Look what happens in times of so-called peace. Especially nowadays, the time of peace is a cold war. And it's perhaps almost less bearable than a hot war. Sometimes. This committee, that group investigating something and drawing up a report and so forth. How is it all done? In terms of one's personal interests, to get the best out of all the others. But if I try to get the best out of all the others, I will also be destroying myself, for the very simple reason that what I call others are in actual fact, the fact of nature, not so other than I myself. This is what everybody forgets. So you see the implications of these simple teachings of the great spiritual teachers as regards dealing with oneself. The veils have to be removed. Now, if one is poised, quiet, unselfed, then you are in full relationship with the other person. If the other person is not like that, the difficulties are great, of course. But supposing both people understand this matter, husband and wife, brother and sister, parent and child, teacher and pupil, employer and employee. If we understand, if both parties understand it, naturally there will be harmony. This doesn't mean that there will be no difficulties, no problems, no pain. Of course pain, difficulties, problems will always be there, because it is in the nature of the cosmic process to give rise, temporarily at least, to conditions which are painful. An earthquake takes place, a flood. There you are, you've had it. Sinner or saint, you've had it. So you see, we mustn't have misconceptions of that sort. And remember that those misconceptions are born of our own desire to possess this, that or the other pleasant thing. It's this wretched pleasure drive in us which is the greatest obstruction to true human fulfillment. We forget, constantly forget, that the pleasure drive is no other than the pleasure-pain drive. Because the pleasure drive is restricted to the realm of duality, the realm of mortality. We think of pleasure in terms of a succession of pleasurable experiences. Wheresoever we have a succession of experience, we are caught in that state where there is a beginning, a proceeding, an ending. Birth, death. Birth, death. But now, take the other aspect, take another aspect of the deep teachings. See the fact as the fact. Be wholly mindful and therefore wholly attentive. Attentive not in the exclusive sense, in the exclusive manner, but in the inclusive manner. And be wholly attentive to the immediate now. Have you ever tried it? Have you ever practiced this really? See what happens. Something is happening. Let us say that we are listening to some music or we are at the opera. Right. We know something about the opera. We know the story of it and so forth. We have heard others also sing and participate in the opera. And we listen. But we listen with a mind that is preconditioned by our past experience. So-and-so conducted it, so-and-so were the singers, and they sang like this and it was wonderful. You're expecting that, you're wanting that. Now, supposing it doesn't happen that way, and bet your bottom dollar it will not happen that way. The universe is not a process of mechanical, utterly dull, boring, repetitive action. It is not that. It's always new. It's always different. So, as I listen, supposing I'm at the opera, and as I listen, I say, oh, that was good, but my goodness, so-and-so did it better. Oh, this is marvelous. It is better than that. You see, all the time my mind is in a state of confusion. I'm not attending. This is not attention. This is the very reverse of attention, pure attention. But supposing I attended completely in the now, what happens? The event moves through time, because every event functions in terms of the time-space continuum. You can't get free of that. But when attentiveness is complete and pure, that attentiveness is free of the limitations of the time-space continuum. Therefore, there is no beginning or proceeding or ending of the event in your attention, in your consciousness, in terms of comparison, harking back to the past or looking forward to a future, none of which are existent now. If you are fully attentive in the immediate now, you experience, you live the true meaning of immortality in every split second of your existence. This is the only real meaning, at least as far as I can put it in words, of immortality. Immortality has nothing to do with the continuance of the manifested, of the finite, of the mortal, in terms of space and time. That is not the context of immortality. Immortality means this mode of awareness which is present because attentiveness is complete, because the mind is pure, because the senses are functioning freely and fully and completely, and you are free of attachment and aversion, free of demanding anything for yourself in any particular way. Now, whatsoever happens in life happens in terms of a happiness which is utterly nondescript. You can't describe it. There is no limitation to it. It has no relationship with what you and I and the dictionary call joy, rapture, happiness, etc. It's the same with beauty, with goodness, with truth, with love, with wisdom. The words have lost their limiting power. You actually live in this extraordinary condition, a totally different dimension of being and consciousness from the subhuman being and consciousness. Immortality, then, is manifest through the mortal process, the mortal living process of the organism. This is immortality. Look at the difference, therefore, to society, to mankind. If there is even a glimmering of these things, then one is able, naturally, spontaneously, not by trying to force yourself, because you can't do it that way, you'll fail, invariably fail. Naturally, spontaneously. Think of the difference to mankind, to humanity, if there is a glimmering of this thing and one just easily lives like that. Lives at home in the cosmos, so to say. See. What happens to all the questions? What is the purpose of my existence? What is the meaning of life? If you are actually living it, the questions don't arise. Questions arise because we don't know, because we are in a state of ignorance, in a state of confusion. So you see, innumerable such potty questions disappear altogether. What's happened to you yourself? You are free. When you are truly free, when you are truly just, when one lives truly honorably, no one need fight for freedom, justice, honor. It's only the ignorant, it's only the unfree, the unjust, the corrupt, the dishonorable who fight for these things, because they are fighting for a particular concept, a particular definition they have of these things, and they don't know anything about the reality of these things. See what is implied in the emergence of our religiousness into fruition. It's something which will transform, which not only oneself, but the whole world. We'll have a world populated by true humans then, not subhumans. Isn't it an extraordinary thing, a wonderful thing? Now, having said this, beware of girding your loins and summoning your energies to achieve this. If you do that, you will have absolute failure. Why? Oh, I want to do it. You can't get away from it. Be very careful. That subtle devil, the I, you see? And he functions largely through the unconscious part of you, which, like the iceberg, is at least 9/10 of you. You see? No. I don't achieve anything at all. Let be. Just be awake. Just be watchful. When you fall down, see the fact as the fact. Oh, there was a falling down. Don't say, I fell down, because then you'll say, oh, I ought to get up. No, that was a case of a falling down. And if you see it with full attention, you will understand just all that contributed to the falling down. And when you really see that, it is not very likely that you'll repeat the absurd trick of falling down. Well, life has wonderful charm and humor in it, you know, all along the line. Then you can really laugh at your misfortunes. Not the forced laugh, because, oh, I am English, or I am Chinese, I am one who endures, I am stoic, and I am nothing. If I truly realize I am nothing, transcendence takes charge. And when transcendence takes charge, what happens to all of us? We are released, truly, truly released into our right relationship with the transcendent. We are the children of transcendence itself.